Good evening, everybody. James McKenna here with My Science Hour. This is for September 28th, 2023, and a lot going on, a lot, and just reaffirming one of my premises that I have always worked on, really, throughout my entire career, and it just was reaffirmed again recently that I work alone. I work. I am very gracious and things like that. I'll talk to have some more commentary about this kind of thing a little later in the show, but it's like you. I know where I'm going. I know what I'm doing. I know where, for various aspects of, say, the business aspect of things that I do. And whenever you trust someone else, that's a lot of times they turn out to I don't know, the term is going south. Anyway, like I say, that all of my science work, and people always want to corroborate or talk or can I help you with this or something like that, and literally. I just have always said no. And a couple of times that I've helped and gotten help from people, it turns out to funny. Let's just put it that way. So anyway, just reaffirming my lifelong belief. And for example, that's why this radio show is still here, is that I pay for my own airtime. The only income that I have is from, say, you buy water filter products or other products from the educational products, the books, the CDs, all of that stuff. And anyway, but I appreciate the people out there who are supportive and also, very importantly, respectful of privacy. And that's right. And when I talk to people on the phone or customers, they're always, can I ask you a question? They're very respectful, and if I'm busy, well, I'm busy right now. Okay, and they're just very happy to talk to me, sometimes just for a few minutes if I'm busy. But so thank you all the people out there who are very respectful of my time and privacy and all of those other things. Okay. Anyway, the wintertime frequency now is happening, and I was on a couple radio shows, and people called in. They said, "Hey, your last week's show, we didn't hear it because it was apparently moved to a different frequency." And that happens because at WWCR, where I have been hosting this show for 23 years now, at the same time slot, right at that 6 p.m. Central Time. And that's the cusp between winter time and summertime. And they used to change it at the same time as the clocks changed, but now there's a little bit of a difference there. But at any rate, we are now on the winter time frequency, which is 5.935 megahertz. 5.935 megahertz. And that'll be into the springtime where we change again. And of course, it did change as last week was the 21st. The 23rd, which was, I believe, last Saturday, was the actual fall equinox. And there's the spring solstice, and then there's the winter solstice. And then the equinoxes are where the spring solstice is the longest day of the year. The winter solstice, which usually occurs around December 21st, is the shortest day of the year. And the equinoxes are where the day and night time are the same time, 12 hours. 12 hours for the daytime, 12 hours for the nighttime. And that occurred last Saturday, but they changed the frequency from what I understand for my last week's show. And so anyway, yeah, the wintertime frequency until next spring. And then it's also simulcast. I think it's 6.115 megahertz, or 6.113, 6.115. I can't remember offhand. One of those two, but you can find it there. If you get to one of those, you'll hear it and then tune it in. And I encourage people also to have a shortwave radio, and in spite of the fact that this airs on podcast platforms, it airs on Truth Be Told Radio Network, it airs, of course, on WWCR, it re-airs Friday night in WTWW, shortwave, out of Nashville, but the primary show is this shortwave show on WWCR that, you know, Worldwide Christian Radio is what it's called. And through my science, through my teachings, of course, I propound the Christian philosophy, which I think, in my opinion, is the best one, the best living philosophy that's ever been developed. The other ones that might have a large influence worldwide, in a sense, copied the Christian religion. They are offshoots. All of them are offshoots. And with the variations, of course. But I think that Christ had it down. I think he had the right perspective. And sometimes, you know, they say Christians are these meek, humble people. You know, somebody slaps you, turn the cheek and let them slap you again. But no, in throughout history, Christians have been pretty rough characters, let's put it that way, when it comes to stepping on their rights. And of course, the United States was started as a Christian country. When the Europeans came over, they were persecuted because of religious intolerance. And they started a country where you could practice your religion and practice your beliefs as long as they don't tread on somebody else, of course. Anyway, and sometimes that openness goes a bit too far. It has its drawbacks. I saw an article the other day where they were talking about being kind to people can have backlashes that are negative. In other words, if you're too good to some people, they come around and you know, smash your nose into the dirt and try and take advantage of you. And that's happened to me, in fact, recently, like I say. But at any rate, I want to jump into this next topic here. Declining cities in the United States. Now, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to understand that the major cities in the United States, they've all been taken over by this Mayor Daley political model. And the, you know that, but I should qualify that a little bit. Mayor Daley was just a corrupt guy with a lot of gangsters and, you know, the mob running things and the early days of the intelligence agencies out of Washington and corruption, drug trafficking, human trafficking, and all the other things that are going on today with the intelligence agencies and the federal government. But what they did is they perfected the stuffing of the ballot box and getting, like, the unions to vote for the Democrats to get the these groups, various groups, and believing that they were going to get something better. But the end result, it kept some very corrupt people in office. But now what's going on is the alignment with the Communist Manifesto. And somebody called in, it was yesterday, I was a guest on John Moore's show, and a guest called in, a listener, and said about all the craziness going on in the cities and this kind of thing. What's my comment? My comment was that this is the Communist Manifesto playing out. Great examples throughout history in the Russian Revolution when the Bolsheviks and the Mensheviks were going at it early 1900s. The European bankers, the Rothschild banking empire, was supporting both sides, funding them, providing arms. You know, it was the old, you know, protection racket. And they used the universities where the proletariat, the commoners, were against the rich people. And that's an easy one to pull off because when, especially early 1900s in Russia, I mean, can you imagine? I can't even imagine what it would be like, you know, with a very relatively small population, people living a lot in rural areas, very tough living standards. And And a lot of poor people living just off the land. It was a hard, hard life. Probably much harder than the American pioneers, I might guess, who had a much milder climate to deal with. Russia is north. In most of the Russian cities, even though they're tempered by the North Atlantic current, which warms Northern Europe quite a bit, it's still harsh, very harsh lifetime lifestyle, short lifetime expectancy, etc. And so it would be easy to convince the people that, hey, it's those darn rich people over there that are all your cause of all your problems. And so and that's what happened. But in what's going on in the United States today is simply divisive, pitting people against each other, everything from defund the police to support the police, blacks against whites, racism against racism, the political opponents against political opponents, and just divisive division of the country. Mothers against sons, sons against fathers, brothers against brothers, cousins against cousins. Everybody's, you can't get two people in a room to talk about any subject without them disagreeing vehemently in a very short amount of time. This is the Communist Manifesto being played out in the United States. Wow, and it's just what's going on. So the decline of the United States cities. Now, where do these mayors and these people come from that are running these cities? This city councils, the school boards, the councilmen, etc., that operate in these cities, they are handpicked, and down to the judges, the people in agencies. These people are handpicked and then put in these positions, and it's capitalist cronyism at its best, where people bring in their buddy or their friend or their somebody. Economic confidant, where they're making money off of the government and putting it in their, cutting deals and putting it in their back pocket, making these American cities just destroying themselves from within. A great example is in San Francisco, where you have hundreds, literally hundreds of thousands of homeless people living on the street, drug addicts. And the chief police of police there said that 97% of them are not from San Francisco. They're from other places. But what are they doing? The mayor's giving out free drugs, needles, and so these people just flock there. And then the city has this increasing budget every year to deal with the homeless problem, but their corruption, moving the drugs out to the street to the users, and then the city's paying for it. Wow, I mean, what a gig. As the cities crumble and crime increases, etc. So then we have the looming federal government shutdown, which is pending here. And there again, it's a situation where you have political parties pitted against political parties, and nothing is getting done, nothing positive. Okay, so I just wanted to bring that out because it just reinforces the idea that you have to get out of these core cities. If you got out into the suburbs, potentially that's pretty good. Things are still operating relatively normally. Or out into the country where people are becoming pioneers, literally over again, and redefining the educational system, homeschooling, etc. Okay. My main topic I'm going to continue the discussion that I really didn't have much time last week on the aurora borealis and the electric solar system. I'll be talking about that. But a few other comments on scientific issues here. There's been a big to-do about an asteroid called Bennu. And in 19, I'm sorry, not 19, in 2021, samples were taken from a remote robotic spacecraft, and these samples were taken, surface samples, where they put them in a container And this container just came back to Earth. It just landed the other day, and it was out in the desert, the American Southwest desert. This thing came in at like 23,000 miles an hour. That's like escape velocity from Earth. In other words, if you wanted to escape from Earth's gravitational field, you would have to get up to a speed of around 25,000 miles an hour to do it. And this baby came in at that speed and had to slow down and then aerobrake, in other words, use the Earth's atmosphere as a braking mechanism, and then launch a couple parachutes, deploy parachutes, and then this thing floated down and landed softly in the American Southwest. And the people, it was said that the lead scientist on this panel was crying. He was just overjoyed that these rocks came back. But the real scientific story is that these rocks that they're on the surface of asteroids have nothing to do with the asteroid. And unfortunately, the so-called science that would be done has already been determined. They got to say, oh, this is from the beginning of the solar system, 4.5, 5 billion years ago. So as with NASA, any NASA probes, etc., the so-called science has already been determined. Now, this would also be like the moon rocks. Remember the famous Apollo moon rocks? And, I'm not going to get into the Apollo program tonight and all of that, whatever. But, they're claiming they brought back moon rocks. Okay, and everybody's studying them, and people sold them on the black market. You buy a piece of a moon rock for a big price, But the idea is that the rocks on the surface of the moon have accumulated over, eons of time, whatever that is, and have nothing to do with the moon itself. So you can pick up all the rocks you want on the moon. It has nothing to do with the moon or the asteroid. So it's, well, of course, this is tier two science also, and that's something that I try and educate the public about, that tier two science is the garbage science that they try and pawn off on you, the public, and I try and educate people, like in my science education supplemental program on my webpage. A topic I talk about a lot is the structure of science. Who are the tier one scientists? Those are scientists you never see their names, you never see them. They do not, I repeat, they do not publish in peer-reviewed scientific journals. Their publications are private. They are employed literally by the military, which goes up the chain to the World Banks. And so they're working for the dark side, and they're the best scientists. They are good scientists. But once they cross that line, they're trapped for life. They cannot go up to a microphone or do something, because they would be killed, their family would be killed, and they know it. So they're trapped. And they sign up for this, they go out of grad school, they get their first postdoc, they're good scientists, they have originality, etc. And I know some of these people. But once they sign that document, and they're, it's going to be a high-paying job, they're going to work in a laboratory, a national laboratory of some kind, potentially, and they're going to be plucked out of the tier two world of science. And I can tell these people when I go to, like, say, American Geophysical Union meeting, I could tell them, and they say, this guy is going to be a tier one scientist. They're very good, they're very naive. Oh my goodness, are these people green behind the ears? Naive. Ooh. And they get, they're doing their science, they're real good. Somebody comes along and says, hey, buddy, we got a real good deal for you over here. You want to be in this group doing the top level research. And of course, they're too stupid to know that it's a trap. And once they get into that, they're going to be using their brain power, their talent for evil. Let's just put it that way. And so they don't know. And a lot of them never figure it out. A lot of them are just stupid. A lot of them become evil. And anyway, back to this Bennu asteroid where the guy was crying about getting the rocks back. They're going to have years of study by teams of scientists. And there'll be lots of publications, but it's all going to be for naught. It's all going to be, oh, yes, 4.5 billion years ago. Now we know more about the beginning of the universe. You know, just junk. Which leads me into the next topic of the James Webb Telescope. Now, the James Webb Telescope, of course, is the replacement, not a replacement, it's the next generation telescope in outer space after the Hubble Space Telescope, which is still working up there doing great science. But the James Webb Telescope, now here's what's been going on. If you go back to Edwin Hubble in the early 1900s, actually they were starting this as much as the late 1800s, putting spectroscopic equipment on telescopes. And these were pretty good telescopes, research-grade telescopes. And they started looking at, that was the first time when they started to realize there were galaxies, these spiral structures in outer space and other objects, which eventually became known as quasars. They started realizing that these were billions of stars in a single structure. And they were noticing that they all seemed to produce a redshift, which is a curious thing. And so at the time, special relativity had just been proven in the laboratory, which it certainly was. I'm not talking general relativity, I'm talking special relativity. And so the immediate thing was to say, okay, all of these things are moving away from us, so the universe is expanding, which started the Big Bang thing. Okay, so then they go to the next generation of telescope and the next bigger one, the next bigger one. And these are earthbound telescopes, the Keck telescopes, the big ones on Mauna Kea, the big ones and down in the desert areas of Peru, eventually some at the South Pole, Antarctica telescopes, and looking into the heaven, they had radio telescopes. But this idea that the signaling was redshifted from these objects, and the idea that that was caused by an expansion of the universe, led to certain theories, and then the idea was that the universe, they calculated based on the redshifts and things called the Hubble's constant and other theoretical work that the universe would be around 13.5 to 14.5 billion years old, and so this Big Bang was where all the matter in the universe came out of the size of a pinhead or smaller, and produced the first stars and galaxies and heavy metals, etc. But the theoretical picture then should have been that, say 100 million years after the Big Bang, galaxies certainly had not formed yet. They didn't have time. You didn't have the stellar structures. And of course, the whole idea of how galaxies form, I have a published paper in peer-reviewed journals, one of two that I have in peer-reviewed published in astrophysics journals, talking about a different model of how galaxies form. But at any rate, now what's going on is the James Webb Telescope. Here's what goes on. Let's follow a step. You take a big telescope. It can see a certain amount of objects in outer space. It can define them. It can the optical term is resolve them, so that you can actually see what they are, so you can magnify that image and actually see what it looks like. But the every next generation telescope then could see farther and farther, etc. So then now they're seeing galaxies that have a redshift would put them just a few hundred million years after the Big Bang, which is like right nose to nose with the Big Bang. So there shouldn't have been time for these galaxies to form, but there they are. James Webb Telescope sees them, and so it sees things that the Hubble Space Telescope could never see. And so it's like, oh, these galaxies are very old. They're some of the first objects in the universe to form after the so-called Big Bang. But they're fully formed. They got all the stars. They have all the properties of stars, just like our own galaxy. And so the story falls apart, the Big Bang story. But what happens in standard science? Well, doggone, that's okay. We just have to adjust some parameters here and there. In college, we used to call them Schwanz factors. And what would happen is there were guys that were not, I would say they were not honest. Let's just put it, say it exactly the way it is. They'd go into a lab, and they didn't want to spend a lot of time on the lab, so they'd get the beginning results. They knew what the final results were supposed to be because it would talk. We knew they had the theoretical work in the textbooks, so they knew what the final results should be. And so then they would just sit down and work a bunch of numbers and equations. And so then matching, bridging the beginning, what the experiment was, creating the data, literally creating the data, the error bars and everything on the statistical spread of the data. And voila, you got a lab report. And so basically, what they were doing was cherry-picking the data and creating results that were not real. So it appears that some of these people have gone to get PhDs in astrophysics and went on to perfect that in the real world. So the end result, though, is that the Big Bang, once you peel back the first onion layer, it does not make any sense. And I've talked about this a lot, but I just wanted to mention here that there's, and people started pointing this out as soon as the James Webb Telescope started seeing these galaxies well developed that were supposedly billions of years old, 12, 13 billion years old. So just a couple hundred million years after the supposed Big Bang, there's no way that they could possibly develop in that short amount of time. So the whole story should go out the window with the baby in the bathwater, as they say. Okay. Just a quick note here. Tomorrow night, September 29th, the fall harvest moon, called a supermoon, and I saw it tonight for a little bit. And it's kind of neat when you see it through the clouds because it gives you some perspective and it really looks big. So if you have a chance, go outside just after sunset. Let's watch this moon rise off the horizon. And a beautiful harvest moon. So, and that's what happens. A lot of times this harvest moon occurs in the fall. It's called a harvest moon because it occurs right at the time of the harvest. And sometimes it takes on some orange properties. But we'll see what'll happen. Just want to mention quickly about my MR5 whole house water systems. The MR5 best deal package, that includes the MR5 whole house water filter. That includes the extra pack of filter elements that go along with that. It includes the UV sterilizer, which is an optional item, but is included in the best deal. And that comes with two UV bulbs, and they have to be changed out every year. So you get 2 years of service out of the UV sterilizer as it comes in the package. And then, of course, people buy more filter elements if they want more in stock, you know, for that rainy day. But anyway, the point is that the best deal is on sale for a remarkably low price of $1,380. That's $1,000 off the full retail price. And the reason I'm doing that is to catch up on some bills and to also help pay for some of the new developments that have been going on. And just in general, you know, any business today, you have to be competitive if you're going to stay in the business at all. And, you know, I'll just mention this also. Had a customer the other day called up and actually ordered an MR5 system. And he said, well, should I buy extra filter elements? And I said, well, it's a personal choice. Depends on how much money you want to spend, how much money you have to spend. And I said, well, you know, I've been in business 23 years. I don't have a crystal ball, but you know, the way the world is going, you don't know. I mean, you don't know what's going to be around the corner in next week even. But so I encourage people to, if they are thinking about that, if they have a mindset where they want to prepare for the future, that sure, pick up an extra couple sets and then save the old ones, the old filter elements, when you change them out. The MR5 filter elements last for 55,000 gallons, but you know, that doesn't mean they're just bad. That means that they've gone from 97% down to 92% or something. They're still good. Dry them out, put them in the closet for a rainy day when, you know, who knows? And then the same with the gravity filters. I'm selling the gravity filters. They're $189 for a 4-pack and $399 for a 10-pack, and that includes free shipping to the entire United States, 50 states. The other products, the bigger products, have free shipping to the 48 states, and then Alaska and Hawaii pay a little bit extra, but really it's not much extra. So I encourage you to look at that, the web page, to go right to the MR5 web page, type in my MR5.com. That's easy to remember. MyMR5.com. So five letters, numbers. So it's MyMR5.com. And if you're looking for the gravity filters, go to the website, the main website, which is JMCCWaterFilters.com. And also have a really beautiful stainless steel sink filter. That's my opinion, it's the best one on the market. Okay, enough of that. But go check that out. That sale will not last long. That's going to go away very soon. So if you have an inkling to get a whole house water filter, now is the time to do that. Last Sunday, and this was a little bit of a kind of a parable, kind of let's say, a biblical story, and it happened that I went to a church service, and the gospel for the day was very apropos for anyway. And so here's what it amounted to. It's the, and I'm sure you've heard this, is the landowner has a vineyard. He's a vineyard, and he goes out at the beginning of the day, and he hires people who are waiting for work, and he says, go into the vineyard and work, and he agrees on a certain set pay. Okay, and so then the workers go out and they start working, and then the owner goes into town a little later, and he says, he sees some guys standing around. He says, hey, go out in the vineyard, and you know, he says, why aren't you working? He says, well, because nobody's hired us. He goes, well, get out in my vineyard there and earn your daily pay. And so even as late as 5 in the afternoon, like an hour before the closing time of work, he goes out and he sees some guys standing around and says, how come you're not working? He says, well, nobody's hired us. He said, well, go out in the vineyard and work. And so when they all come in, he pays them in reverse order. So he pays the guys that were there the shortest amount of time first. And he pays them the full day's wage, and then he gets up to the guys who work there all day, and they go, well, wait a minute, you're paying us the same as those guys. Those guys just showed up at the end, and we worked all day in the hot sun and everything. And the owner says, hey, look, I'm the owner. I get to pay people what I want. I'm the owner of the business here. And so don't complain. You're getting what was agreed upon. And so anyway, the idea is that the kingdom of heaven is like that, you know, everybody is different. Some people put their whole life dedication into it, but the idea is that the owner is the guy that determines how much somebody should be paid. And there's can be quibbling and things like that, but the idea is. And so it's a really an apropos section from the Bible, which describes, in a lot of cases, real life situations. Okay, just one other quick thing here. A NASA boondoggle. Now, I'm sure you've all heard about the International Space Station, and this thing has been up there. It was partially built by Russia. In fact, most of what's there was launched from Russian territory. A lot of people may not know that. The U.S. may have built the modules, or may have collaborated with European Space Agency or something to build some of the equipment. But primarily, it's American money, but launched by Russia. Because remember, during the big outage of the space shuttle, and the United States really did not have any heavy lift rocket capability, all of this stuff going on. And so the United States never really launched the stuff that's up there on the space program. And now, of course, with the difficulty in Ukraine, the Russians and the United States, I don't know, they were trying to work together. But at any rate, at this point, the NASA is pulling the plug on the space station, and they want it to deorbit and come in to a fiery end for a spectacular show. And they want ideas on how to deorbit this thing. So anyway, that goes right into the mouth of my science with and I'm not going to go into detail on that right now, but one of my science projects back in the 80s when I was working in Los Angeles with venture capital groups, this is on my scientific work, I was developing exactly that kind of a system, a system that would extend orbits or deorbit or work with satellite systems to dock them. And it was a whole series of implementations of a propulsion system that I designed. So at any rate, but the point is that here NASA wants to smoke this space station and perfectly good equipment. Now that equipment, you might say, is past its lifetime, but not really. Not really past its lifetime. There should be a considerable amount of use out of that still. In fact, instead of burning it up, just give it to me. I'd be very happy to take it off their hands. A nice space station, already functional, already up in orbit with a lot of capability. I'll just give it to me. Don't trash it. Don't throw it in the garbage. Don't burn it up coming back into the atmosphere. Give it to somebody that'll make decent use of that. Okay. Anyway, enough of that. So now I'm going to talk again. Now, I'm sorry, last week I ran up against the clock at the end of the show. I was talking about the Aurora Borealis. Now, that's the Northern Lights. And I mentioned that they actually make noise. They make a hissing noise, and I've heard this. I have heard myself because I spent a good deal of time up in the Canadian wilderness. Remember when I came back from Cornell, I went up on, it started as a springtime canoe trip because I was, I don't know what day I left Cornell, Ithaca, New York. And I was, let's put it this way, after 2 years, I was not renewed in my second teaching position there, which was in the math department. The astronomy astrophysics department came over and put the heavy hand on them. Professor Wolfgang Fuchs was the chairman of the mathematics department, a very genteel, wonderful old man. And he called me into his office. And he said, your teaching is great. The students love you. Your performance here is very good. You are publishing in peer-reviewed astrophysics journals. You're the only faculty member in the history of the mathematics department at Cornell who has ever done that. And they want me to fire you. And I'm like, you know, I had calculus classes. 395 students that petitioned for me to keep teaching their calculus class. And in spite of this, I was let go because I was publishing my work in astrophysics journals. Now, put that in your pipe and smoke on it. Imagine this is happening to you. So anyway, when I left Cornell, the It was a pretty sad day, let's just put it that way. Driving up out of Ithaca, and I've not been back there since. I should go back to Cornell just to see what it's like. But I went back to I ended up in northern, in central Ontario, let's just put it that way. And it started out as a canoe trip through the river systems of central Canada, fishing and living off the just daily fishing from a canoe trip. And then it extended into the fall, and then fall became winter, and I stayed there, and I literally lived outside. And that's where you see the aurora borealis on a sometimes on a daily basis. You can see it's far enough north that you can see up to the Arctic Circle. That's how far north I was. And of course, being a physicist, I was looking at the aurora borealis with an understanding of the physics going on here. Okay, so in any rate, also one day I was out on a I was and working in an area up on a deck. That was it was just a deck in the middle of the woods, and it started raining, but there was a perfectly blue sky, and so the leaves were responding to this, and there was no wind. It was a perfectly still day, and I could hear like raindrops. I'm looking up, and I go, "What the heck is going on here?" And of course, I was just standing there. There was nothing raining. I held my hand out. There's no rain. It was an electron proton storm from the sun that was reaching all the way down to where I was on in the forest, in a big opening in the forest. And the leaves on the trees, like the aspen and the birch trees, were responding to this. They were waving as if water droplets were hitting them. Very interesting. But this was, and of course, in the daytime, you don't see the auroras because it's too light out. There's too much light. You only see them at night. But the auroras are basically high-energy particles coming in from the sun in streamers, and they follow the magnetic field lines down to what is known as the ring current. It's a band, it's a ring of electrical current that circles the North Pole, and it's one of the upper atmospheric high altitude jet streams that is coupled to the Earth's magnetic field. So these are plasma currents up in the upper atmosphere, and that's where the these high energy particles come down. They feed down into this, and occasionally this ring current can expand all the way down to where it's a ring of current around the Earth, all the way down to, say, Mexico City. Whereas they've seen the aurora borealis as far south as Mexico City, if you know where that is. I believe that's about 17 degrees north latitude. I used to live there. I used to live in Mexico City a couple years. My very first teaching job was in Mexico City, but I don't recall seeing auroras there myself. But they have gone that far south, is my point. But okay, back to the science of this. Now the sun has a proton current that is it's a generated. I talked about this last week, the physics of how the coronal holes open up, and the it's like a screen, it's like a grid of negative charge that surrounds the sun, and when the blasts from the fusion explosions, when the positively charged protons come out in a streamer, they will blast a hole through the electron shield, the corona of the sun, and one then they're accelerating out as if they were moving out on the inside of a Van de Graaff bell. Now, people that were trying to understand this, in fact, I had some tier one scientists come out and ask me how this process works because they can measure it. They could see it, but they didn't know how it worked. And I said, well, it's the same scenario as the inside of a Van de Graaff bell, where the that keeps charging up and charging up and charging up until the leakage current off the surface balances it and you just can't charge it anymore. And then there's a return current sheet, which happens in approximately the month of August. And that's why we have the aurora borealis. the hurricane season, we have the tornado season peaking in the month of August because of that return current sheet. These are all things that I discovered because of my theoretical work, and I was able to determine these things using some NASA data, but primarily by understanding the principles involved. You cannot just keep charging this Van de Graaff type of charging scenario in the solar system. You just can't keep doing it forever. There has to be a return current sheet to balance the current load, and that comes, where does that come? Well, what's the significant signs? It's the hurricane, the tornado, and the aurora borealis seasons that occur in the month of August. And then they start in June. They all start in June, and they all end around November. And so unless, of course, aurora borealis, you can see if you are in the northern climates, etc., you can see the aurora borealis any time of year. Many times, many nights in a row, you'll see the auroras. And if there's a solar storm going on, which we're potentially going to see some tonight or tomorrow, there's a whole series of sunspots on our side of the sun, any one of which could belch out a big solar flare and create a very colorful aurora borealis, or as they're called, northern lights. Understand also that there are southern lights. South Pole has auroras also, but since the vast majority of people on planet Earth live in the northern hemisphere, and very, very few of them live in the southern hemisphere, is more commonly known as the northern lights. And of course, Jupiter, Saturn, those planets have this also because they have magnetic fields. It's interesting that Venus, for example, does not have auroras. It has a very different reaction to the solar flaring that comes by Venus. Venus does not have any moons, and it does not have any magnetic field. So this is something I like to give credit to a guy named Stan Dermot. He was a Cornell professor when I was there, probably one of the only decent guys I really met there, and in the astronomy astrophysics department. But he, I believe it was his idea that which is empirically correct, but also now I developed the physical models, of course, in my work, that the moons are very much coupled to the magnetic fields. And they're driving, because they are a comet, they're discharging the solar capacitor, they're orbiting, for example, our moon orbits Earth, it goes out of our magnetic sheath twice during its orbit around the sun. It goes in front of us between Earth and the sun once per month, and then once per month it's in the full moon stage, it's behind Earth, where Earth is blocking the solar wind from hitting the moon directly if it's close enough to the ecliptic plane, at least. Okay, so at any rate, the moons are the ones that couple with the planet electrically to create the magnetic fields. And these are we always think of the Earth's magnetic field of, oh, that's due to iron and nickel in the core of the mantle of the Earth. No. Primarily, the magnetic fields of Earth and of Saturn and Jupiter, the big magnetic fields in the solar system, those are the big ones, are due to the moons, not due to some kind of geological material in the core or in the crust or in the mantle. Okay, so at any rate, the aurora borealis then in the magnetic field of Earth are coupled to our moon. And the reason I was talking about Venus does not have a moon. And so therefore it does not have a magnetic field, and therefore what happens is it has an X-ray signature to the sunward side, just like comets. So Venus is acting like a comet. It has no magnetic field. So what does it have? It has an X-ray. It has an X-ray cloud on the sunward side, just like comets. And so Venus, like I say, is acting just like a comet. It has a tail. We cross through it. Remember that I talk about this a lot. You'll see this in my books. Is that when Earth has Venus has an inferior conjunction with Earth, that means that Venus is between us and the Sun, then the viruses on Earth go up. That's a time when we pick up a lot of flu and other types of viruses. And this that cycle is 500, I forget the exact number of days, but every year and a half, which we because Venus is moving around in its orbit, and as we move around once in our orbit after an inferior conjunction with Venus, Venus has moved on, so it takes us a bit of time to catch up to Venus, and for Venus to catch up with us before the next inferior conjunction. But it's a time when two things happen. One is the increase in viruses, flu viruses, and other types of viruses, maybe mainly flu. And the other one is an increase in solar activity, solar spots, sunspots, and solar flaring, etc. And that happens also with other planetary alignments, with either Mars. Mars is a very small effect. Venus is a fairly significant effect. And so it gets that cross solar system discharge. And the military, back in the 90s, I remember, they actually came to talk to me about this and asked me what was going on. But with one of their satellites, they saw this intense electron stream as we connected with Jupiter, as we had a physical, an electrical alignment with planet Jupiter. And they didn't know what was causing this. Well, the cause was that the electrical discharge of the solar capacitor of Jupiter and Earth aligned. And wham, it's like a spark plug. The electrons, of course, being the primary carriers, charge carriers in the current of the discharge, was the cause of satellites seeing this immense electron current when we were in direct alignment, physically, physical alignment and electrical alignment with the planet Jupiter, Earth and Jupiter. Okay, so anyway, this would have affected also the aurora borealis on both planets and the other spots, like, for example, Io, the closest Galilean moon to Jupiter, has a significant auroral spot that follows it as it goes around. And it's both at the North Pole and the South Pole. So Io is actually discharging the Jupiter capacitor. And in one of the very first science articles in Science magazine by the NASA team when the Voyager spacecraft were going by Jupiter, was that the lead scientist, Brad Smith, mentioned this in detail in a sentence. He said that there was a proton wind coming up off the surface of Jupiter, implying, well, they didn't imply anything in the article, but what I realized, of course, which supported my work, was that Jupiter was a small star and it had a proton wind, just like the Sun. It has the exact same physical composition, and it produces many times more energy than it receives from the Sun. Okay, so at any rate, these are some fun facts about the solar system. If you read my weather book, if you want more detail on this, I suggest you read my weather book. Of course, I would start out with the Planet X Comets and Earth Changes book and also the Atlantis to Tesla book as some lead-up material, but the core material is really held in my book. It's called Principia Meteorologia, the Physics of Sun, Earth, Weather, and it's written for the general public and advanced scientists. So, but that's where I discuss a lot of these, including what I call local electrical batteries. LEBs, local electrical batteries. And they're all around Earth, but they're plasma batteries. And they're very useful. They're very useful to, well, the book goes into detail. I'm not going to go into detail on that here because I'm kind of running out of time again. But for students of this, I would suggest you read that book, Principia Meteorologia, The Physics of Sun, Earth, Weather. It's available on my webpage, jmccsci.com. And by the way, I believe by the time this show airs, my very new brand spanking new webpage is going to be up there. I have the jmccwing.com webpage, which is a fairly simple webpage dedicated to the wing generator. I have the jmccwaterfilters.com webpage, which is the information and sales page for the water filters. And then the JMCC SCI is the short URL. It's jmccanniescience.com, but a lot of people misspell that. And but the short URL that gets you to my webpage, my original webpage, is www.jmccsci.com, seven letters. Those are my initials, JMCC, and then SCI is short for science, jmccsci.com. And so you can go there, and all of my books, CDs, the archives of this radio show are there going back 23 years. And the webpage, like I say, by the time this show, like right now, I think the it should be posted as of right now. So you can go take a look at that. And it's going to have daily blogs updated. It's going to be a very interesting new webpage. Okay, so I got about a minute left here. I just want to remind you, the MR5 Whole House Water Filter Best Deal Package. That's the MR5 with an extra pack of filter elements. So you get two sets of filter elements and then the UV sterilizer with two bulbs. That gets you out a couple years in having very fresh water in your home. Like I say, it's like having a clean mountain spring in your home. But an incredible price that's going to go away very soon. $1,000 off that package. Originally, it's $2,380. That includes shipping, free shipping, and $2,380. And now $1,380. A tremendous sale. And once this goes away, it's not going to come back, I guarantee you. Okay, well, that's about it. So, well, thank you for listening. Thank you to all my loyal fans. And like I say at the beginning, thank the people who respect my privacy and the work that I do, all of the things that happen. This is James McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.